Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Thursday stream. We are back, although we missed one on Monday. We didn't miss one on Thursday. I'm just going to double check we are actually live on YouTube because we had that weird episode one time.
No, it all
It
seems to be working this time.
I'm
Once
getting
we're,
paranoid now because we had that
yeah.
weird false start. But no, we I am joined by since this seems to be a Starman and the Zoomer stream again, don't worry. As I keep telling people, Trig is just out doing real life stuff. He's being a real human being. So I have Evelyn with me again,
Hello. I'm here.
and yes, she is here. And we also have a special guest this week. He made his return a few months ago with a pretty epic Murdoch retrospective, and has been a bit busy to do stuff since, I think. But I've linked to our YouTube below. Do you want to introduce yourself, Clossington?
Howdy from America. I was actually just in the UK having drinks
Yes.
with y'all, and then, wouldn't you know it, you guys gave me COVID, and
Oh, it's definitely our fault, that's for
It's
sure.
all our fault,
I
yeah.
was sort of pissed off about that, and I didn't know if I should go on. You guys gave me COVID after buying me so many beers.
It's because you wouldn't drink Guinness, that's why.
Is that some sort of shibboleth,
Oh
or
no,
like I was?
it's because it's an alcoholic probiotic yogurt and it's good for your immune
Oh,
system when you're
okay.
drinking.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
The old marketing of Guinness is good for you, yes.
Yeah. So I was brought on here because professionally I'm a civil engineer who specializes in infrastructure and specifically roads, bridges, retaining walls, railways. And I sometimes dip my feet into architecture. And before this, I had read, I think it was the original article on the skyscraper curse. And it's a fairly intuitive thesis. And you don't need to be an architect or an engineer to properly understand it,
No,
but we'll
it's definitely been one of those things. I will not get the graph up yet. I'll wait to get to that point. But when you explain it to people that, oh, well, because of inflation, and as long as you have a rough idea of what inflation is, and you say, well, that makes land value increase. So there is an incentive to build taller buildings on the same plot of land, and that gets more and more expensive as every single layer you do. So you can kind of tell that there is an inflation effect on land and cities because there is a concentration of ever taller buildings, and even people who are like utter AEIQ grugs will go, oh yeah, oh
It's quite a grug-proof idea, yes. But do go on, Glossington.
yeah. So you don't need an economist or an engineer or an architect to explain the skyscraper curse, but Scrump and I both have experience with the architecture business and construction, and so we'll probably get into the sort of ins and outs and some of the dirty secrets of
Yeah,
the
and
actual
Evelyn's an
construction
economist,
industry.
so. Yeah,
I'm
well.
sorry. So we do have an economist and
Well,
an engineer. I'm an engineer and Evelyn's an economist, so
yeah, right. So, do we actually want to get into explaining what the skyscraper curse is,
well,
or?
I plan to do it in a slightly roundabout way so that I can then kick yous off both into whatever realm of conversation is best. But the skyscraper curse, as I've sent a link in chat for people who want to give it a read, it's free up on the Mises Institute, as all good texts are generally. It's another way of describing sort of Austrian capital theory, which we've been over a few times anyway, so I'll try not to be too intensive with it. But as we've got in the graph here, you can imagine that, up here, your original means of production, you've got things like labor, really intensively produced capital, big machines, big tools that last for a long time, and most importantly, land when it comes to building. And then further down we have, you can imagine this is where the bricks get made, and then the copper is, refined and stretched out into wires, and then it gets the plastic ceiling, and then all the other little bits and bobs and furniture is made, and then at the bottom here you've got a house. And in theory... Yeah,
it's the at one end is the child in the lithium mine, at the other end is the iPhone, yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. And in theory, what happens is, you know, you have... This down the way denotes things at the top being more time intensive and things at the bottom being less time intensive. So buying the consumer good, there's instant satisfaction because you buy the house and you live in it. Whereas in theory, if it's just a house economy, the guy up here that owns land has to turn a profit off his land for years and years and years before he can go all the way around to buy a house. And that's like a really strange way to think about it, but it lets us think about how wages or interest is paid and imputed backwards through this process. And when I was at Mises U earlier this year, I think it was Patrick Newman. Yes. Patrick Newman, possibly, that did the lecture on the business cycle theory. And you know, and during the early part of the week, you look at this graph as just part of the Austrian capital structure. But then they come back and say, well, you know, if you mess with the interest rates, you mess with all the stuff up the top here, like the land, the labour, you know, the sort of almost originary sort of capital, and skew the pricing structures for these things, because you're sending the wrong signals to capitalists about what the sort of demands of the people at the bottom here that want consumer goods is. And that what happens then is you end up with your sort of inflationary process and deflationary process, your boom bust, and then goods in this realm will be correct. And this is what happened in some of the earlier business cycles, like in your panic of 1918 or the early sort of antics of the Federal Reserve. However, as we moved on further and further today, you know, in the 2008, the most recent crisis, it was actually a consumer good. It was fully built houses that collapsed in value because of all the poor sort of choices made in the construction industry above them. And it was because these houses that were bought and sold were so closely tied to credit structures that were also involved in the same thing up here that you have this kind of knock-on effect. And that's even more so the problem now. And as I was saying to you, Scrump, before the show started, that, you know, think of it now, your average worker is not buying his transit van in cash every few years.
No.
His Snap-on tools are basically paid on like a mortgage, and he's got 1,000,006 different license fees to pay, and this, that, and the next thing, a lease on this machine, you know, renting this tool for a day. All of a sudden, these things all become, you know, more roundabout ways of allowing construction to absorb the capital it needs to fulfill its orders. And that means there's more scope for miscalculation and just problems completely. And to bring it back around, what I asked Patrick Newman at the end of his lecture was, well, you know, you said in your lecture that it's generally land and intensive capital that has its price miskewed during the inflationary and deflationary sort of process. And I said, well, you know, if we think about it just now, and inflation we are experiencing at this very moment, is this a consequence of the fact that the credit structure is more pervasive over things that are nowadays consumer goods, you know, especially housing, but even all the way down to the cars you buy and finance, or the fact that you maybe even finance your food, or you finance your furniture, or your electronic
the Amazon,
goods. Yeah.
Get your groceries delivered, pay later stuff.
So what I want to say to you is sort of, is there a more noticeable involvement of sort of financialization and even where you're interacting with construction, or is there fluctuations in prices that seem to make no sense and whatever kind of effects they might have?
Well, I mean, there is something to be said about how perverse it is that you have the ability to finance. I think the meme was that Domino's lets you finance pizza whenever you order out. It's perverse, and attaching that to business cycles and credit fluctuation is very dangerous and dubious. But in terms of the actual construction industry, it's true. But you also have to deal with a little bit more blue collar issues. You know, like certain trees have to deal with certain mites, or you know, you have a manufacturing explosion here, or labor shortage there.
A factory mysteriously burns down over there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, Suez Canal, just, you know, someone crashes into it.
Oh, no,
all of a sudden.
But I don't mind saying that there aren't random, unprecedented events. But these unprecedented events always end up causing greater problems because you have this sort of hampered structure underneath.
So in terms of commodity prices, it's a lot more based on like blood and sweat and acts of God. But in terms of which projects get greenlit, it has a lot to do with, yes, credit expansion, but you're also at the whims of urban planners, state planners. And, you know, they're in response to 2008 and the financial crash, you have urban planners scheming to develop properties in very interesting and perverse new ways that we could get into a little bit later. But yeah, financialization does have an impact on construction.
I would say that for those of you who are still confused about the skyscraper curse, the grug brain version of it is that because there's so much free money going in the market, it makes financial sense on paper to build these ridiculous vanity skyscrapers because land prices are so, as you mentioned, are so high that square footage vertically becomes easier and the credit's easier and basically everything's cheaper than it should be. And therefore, you get the biggest skyscrapers at the apex of the biggest credit bubbles. And usually a new world's tallest building signifies a financial collapse.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think Mark Thornton lists the Chrysler Building, the Empire State Building. There's another one. Then Taipei 101 right around the dot-com bubble, and then the Burj Khalifa right around the 2008 bubble.
Well, the Burj Khalifa was really commissioned and completed after. A lot of people
It was originally planned, and the ground was set for it beforehand.
The Burj Khalifa is an interesting one because it's probably a signifier of an even bigger crash to come. It's if you hold to the theory of the skyscraper curse, we really haven't seen the Burj Khalifa borne out because of the ridiculous situation in places like the Emirates and the weird credit stuff that's been going on there as well. But in terms of ground,
The bullet points that he lists are the Singer Building, which ushered in the panic of 1907, the Empire State Building, of course, which was constructed in 1931. I think it was actually commissioned right before the recession hit. I think it only took like 2 years or something extremely absurd to actually construct. So, and then there were the World Trade Centers and Willis Tower, 73 and 74.
That's one of the ones in the Midland Mist, yeah.
That coincided with the oil shocks. And then he cited the Petronas. How do you pronounce it?
Petronas. I think it's Petronas.
Towers,
which were constructed in Kuala Lumpur in 98. It coincided with the Asian financial crisis, which was sort of it was like the Asian tigers, like East Asian economies were flush with American cash. However, it was sort of a speculative bubble, and it crashed like the dot-com bubble, and you had a financial crisis in 98. And then you had the Burj Khalifa, which was completed in 2010, but its construction happened. It began construction a little just before 2007, so that coincided. The grug brain explanation, as you say, is that whenever the economy is artificially flush with cash due to central banking stimulation. When it is most flush with cash, you'll see the greatest developments in vertical construction. Whenever the economy is most flush with cash, they spend it on the biggest buildings. And then a few years later, when when, as Austrian business cycle theory predicts, the speculative bubble will crash because of malinvestment. And just around the time where the buildings are constructed, when the economy is most flush with cash. And then a few years later, once the market corrects for malinvestment, just around the time when these buildings are completed, bang, there's some sort of market collapse.
Oh yeah, that's you used the key word there, malinvestment. And I think it's just one of the best sort of thought out examples of how malinvestment means you end up with capital spent on something that isn't actually a feasible economic good. I mean, I think what's the one other people have broke it down? You imagine you're going to build a building and it takes 12,000 bricks, and you set your budget for the bricks by asking some guy how much bricks are going to cost in 6 months when you've finished it and you need to pay for them. And he says, oh, it'll be 20 pence a brick. And you finish the building and say, oh, no, sorry, actually it was 25 pence a brick. So you can't afford to complete it. You know, it's such a simple concept, and there's a lot of other stuff around it that you know, for some people who don't leap into economics straight away, they maybe don't grasp. But it is just that simple. It's like they've been given the wrong signals about what building to build, and then they get to the end of it and they don't have the materials because they were never there in the first place. But you said sort of earlier on as well, there were then all these other, you know, extraneous and sort of unsystematic effects that happen at the same time. I mean, you've got lockdown, which basically shut down most building sites in Britain for months at a time. I don't know how that was in the States as well. You've then had the supply chain problems, which meant even though the prices hadn't gone up yet, nobody could get anything. And then you had this sort of combination of malinvestment and supply shocks in the last 6 months, where now that some stuff is starting to come back across, everyone's chomping at the bit to get it, so everyone's paying a premium.
Right. I remember, I think it was Mark Thornton, in one of the Mark Thornton lectures that I listened to in preparation for this, he cites that when the economy is most flush with capital, you also see all sorts of new investments in development of new technologies these innovations would not have had any sort of capital investment.
Yeah, this is one of the things Per Bieland talks about.
Yeah, yeah.
And the effect of subsidies.
Like, you can, so these developers both have the cash to actually invest in much bigger buildings, but they'll also have the ability to construct them with all these investments in innovation. So it's yeah. In the US, we had a lot less stringent. Well, my impression is that we had a lot less stringent labor restrictions during COVID. I'd say that our tables were only knocked back maybe construction season. Maybe knocked back by 6 months. And we had all sorts of weird, perverse, you have to wear a mask on a construction site, yada, yada, yada. But when you're dealing with blue collar guys, they don't really pay too much attention to it. Then there was the actual vaccine mandate. I think it actually took out about 15% of all railway workers, I believe it was. I think that's the statistic that a friend of mine cited. But I think they actually stuck it out and kept their jobs anyways. So
from a ground level point of view, I think, as we talked about off air, it's honestly, I think, worse now than it was during the pandemic in some ways. Because then there was a lot of subsidy around. There were a lot of people who were, it was kind of paused, but we hadn't felt the real punch in the gut yet. We hadn't been fully kicked in the teeth. And as you mentioned with the bricks, I know you've noticed it too, that the price of certain things that I need for a project that were signed off maybe in 2020, just before the pandemic, have doubled in value. Or they've gone up by at least a third. And it's like everything is now subject to some to the skyscraper curse, that all projects are kind of struggling. And here in the UK, and what we talked about during our stream called the Infinite Council State was the fact that all the building that I'm privy to in London has all basically been financed by the government in some way. Most of it is heavily subsidized housing projects that I've been involved in. And all of those, if they were to collapse, would default to the local authority and the government as a lender of last resort. That here in the UK, there's actually a perverse incentive for them to set up all these construction projects to fail, because it means they get a whole bunch of social, you know, what would be classed as like Section 8 housing out of it in the US. They get a whole bunch of public sector housing out of it if these developments fail. And it means they are kind of in a no-lose situation. They either get some return on their investment, or they're able to take over these buildings and force people through the back door, really, to have giant vertical council estates in the sky. It's kind of been shocking to see something I'd theorized about a bit in practice.
Well, I think as well, I think we kind of mentioned this in one of the previous streams, certainly related to some of the stuff in London, that even with all this sort of jiggery pokery going on, the only way for it really to be profitable is for much of the construction industry in Britain to be sort of vertically integrated into itself, so that the same parent company can hand the building at several stages of production down to different subsidiaries, so that you can each get different grants, different subsidies, write the building off at a different value, and, you know, create sort of involve themselves in a sort of bizarre shell game that ultimately all feeds back up into the sort of one parent company.
Yeah, I know you'll have experienced this as well, Clossington. When you're trying to cost something, what happens is if you have several different layers of subcontracting, something that's gone up, say, 7% at a ground level, once someone's added their 20% profit to it and then another 20% profit to it, the people of them have added another 20% profit to it, you end up with stupid figures of things costing suddenly millions of pounds more, when really only at a ground level they only cost a couple of thousand more. But because everyone, you know, say you've got the main contractor, you've got below them, you've got, say, the engineering or general contractor, you've got below them, like, let's say, a plumbing contractor. Then below them, you've got a plumbing company. Then they might subcontract the labor out to plumbers if they're short of staff. So whatever the plumber is charging more because of inflation will be amplified by several times, because each of that layer of subcontractor will have to take more of a cut, or will have to take more because they have to get their cut. Or they'll lose money, which means that everyone's losing money in this process.
Yeah, I think it's a general trend ever since, like, say, like the 1970s, to increase the number of subcontractors that you actually have, just to cover your ass in terms of liability.
Yeah.
Like, in terms of liability and specialization, like if you want to complete like an infrastructure project, you'll have a main contractor, and then for main design contractor, maybe have like environmental engineering subcontractors, a few like geoengineering like specialists to cover certain issues, and then you might have like a design contractor and partnering with a construction contractor who subcontracts other parts of the project out to other specialists. And then you have, of course, the actual material suppliers, and you have multiple layers of policing, as Scrump says.
What I was going to say is, well, part of this, though, not to fully foot the blame at companies involved in construction, but that for hiring temporary and especially specialist employees over short periods, by the time that you add in, what would be the phrase, like payroll taxes, and you meet this, that, and the next labour requirement, it's actually cheaper just to pay them for 3-4 months, pay them a premium as a contractor, and then for them to claim that they're self-employed and deal with, as you said, those liabilities themselves. You know, it's sort of, like, it works both ways in that kind of sense.
Like, just as like an infrastructure engineer, most municipalities, like counties and cities, they contract out all of their engineering services to some mega firm rather than having their own in-house engineers. So they'll have like some big contractor be in charge of, you know, like road and bridge and water inspections. And then if something bad happens, they'll just contract out like work, of course, with the county's permission, of course. But yeah, and instead of having like a traveling specialist, whenever something goes wrong, they'll just have this sort of contracted out bureaucracy handle things on its own, on their own. But I can't think of too many things wrong with it, other than when something big goes wrong, you know, you don't actually have a responsible, well, you do have like a district engineer responsible for when things do go wrong, but it's a lot harder to put the blame on one contractor in particular when something does go wrong.
I can give you an example, actually, of how the house of cards can collapse with nested kind of subcontractors. I used to work for a company that did that. Basically, all their staff sent in invoices. They weren't on staff. And I went on holiday for 2 weeks. And when I came back, basically all the guys who were contractors, because the sales guys had fucked up and not brought the work through, they'd all just left. Mm-hmm. They'd all started sending invoices into somewhere else. And basically overnight, that business disappeared because they were trying to be lean and just, you know, have labor when they needed it, not have labor when they needed it. But when there was a gap in the workload, they just lost all their labor. And that's what can happen if there's a gap, say, caused by the lockdowns or inflation or any of that. If there's a period of economic strife, by not having kind of an older style as we used to, employee relationship in which people are looked after, it means that you lose skills incredibly quickly. I don't want to jump there. There's a bit more when I get to, before we get to that. But what's happened in the US and the UK is that they try and plug all these gaps in all these different areas with Pajits, essentially. You end up with like the mass Pajit hiring of people with degree mill degrees who are, it might be that you decide to move on to a different job. Your company can't find an employee, so they'll go out to some recruitment firm who'll say, oh, we've got, you know, Mr. Madurka Singh. He's qualified in India. He's a structural engineer. You know, he's got all these years experience. And he's some farmhand who ordered it off the internet, basically. There's a lot of that in the, you know, it's a joke about the dinghy doctors and all that. But there's a lot of that in the UK where you get people with dubious overseas qualifications that are put into roles when you have skill shortages. And I think that's kind of part of the equation I've been seeing in the collapse way, in that you end up with all these governments going, well, we might not have any engineers or skilled people or skilled laborers, but we'll just bring them in from some undetermined magical labor pool overseas.
Yeah, I'm a lot less familiar with that issue in particular. Like in the US,
you just like ship Mexicans over. It's easier.
Well, that's much more on the construction end of things, where like in whenever I'm working on a demolition project, in New York City, I mostly deal with like Italian and Polish like construction workers and contractors.
Hey,
and maybe the odd like Mexican crew here or there, and then like a few like sort of like blue collar wasp types like welding. But in terms of degrees, yeah, we have like on the design end of things, you do have like a lot of like Chinese, like fresh off the boat engineers brought in. I don't think I've actually seen any like degree mill, like degree mill scams. I think that might unfortunately we didn't have Cringewalker come in, but I think that's much more of like a city thing.
It is. It definitely is.
Yeah.
I've definitely heard stories of folk I know, you know, you know, doing a bit of labouring on a site because, like, their dad has a van and does a bit of bricklaying or something like that. And they'd be like, oh, aye, there's, you know, there's a bunch of Polish boys turn up at 10 o'clock in the morning. They throw a wall up in 3 hours and then they all go home. I've definitely heard of some of those before.
I'm not really talking about that. It's happening with skilled here in the UK. It's actually happening with quote unquote skilled people.
In the way that you would have, you know, a van full of three or four guys that would go out and do, you know, two or three houses worth of bricklaying a day. There isn't people trained through apprenticeships, or there isn't enough small teams to be out on call to do that stuff, you know, there and then. So what actually happens is, the guy on site that knows a guy, phones some, you know, Polish dude, speaks Polish down the phone, and the guy, you know, a team full of guys turn up 15, 20 minutes later. That's what I'm saying, that there is no like UK sort of industry for a lot of that stuff. A lot of the here and now stuff that needs to be done will be done by basically immigrant groups of folk that are operating unofficially.
Sorry, I got a couple of donations here. Thank you. Jay Burden said, came for the T-gram and stayed for the real estate. And Glenn the Duck says, Silicon Valley is almost exclusively Pajits now. Yeah, the Silicon Valley mindset is starting to seep into some of the more technical engineering stuff, which is a very, very, very bad combination. You don't want people who are effectively incompetent or semi-competent dealing with projects in which things need to bear load and not crush people. It gets very Chinese garbage concrete very quickly at some points then.
Yeah. In the US, at least when I was going to university, we had a ton of like Pajit and Chinese computer science majors, but for civil engineering it was, I guess, one of the last like WASP strongholds. Where you had like these blue collar guys going in for like construction engineering or like civil engineering, so they could do like land development or something like that.
I would say it's probably the same over here. It's just the problem that most of them don't really cut it, and even if they do, it's so difficult now to start your own sort of construction, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of company, depending on whatever aspect it is. And, you know, I think about it, my papa, he used to have basically his own, you know, one-stop shop for, you know, what does he need done? Is it, you know, hanging drywall? Is it doing tiles? Is it wiring? Is it this, that, and the next thing? They would do it. And he was able to set that up as just some bloke. Whereas nowadays, you would need, you know, probably something approaching about £100,000 worth of equity to borrow against to even really start your own, you know, man in a van, do somebody's drywall, fit a toilet kind of thing. It's just not, you know, even if you go and get the skills, there is no way for you to profitably use the skills.
Yeah, I mean, in the US, it's very, like, we actually do have a very decent economy for small-scale labor. Like, there are, of course, when it comes to engineering companies, there are these massive mega firms, and then there are very, very small niche subcontractors. And there are a few middling firms. And then you have, like, this is just for steadily employed work. And then you have firms created sort of out of thin air to complete mega projects that they'll work their employees like 60, 80 hour work weeks for a year or two. And then once the project is over, the company just goes bust. In terms of like which companies are incentivized to use this cheap overseas labor, I mean, I guess it's just the mega firms they'll bring over the slaves or.
Yes. I had an experience once where I was on a work site where all the labor was brought in basically in shipping containers from China. We had to shut that work site down, actually. It was incredibly unsafe. We had people doing like comedy wobbles on stepladders, and we had one guy perched like an owl on some of the fire suppression pipe work. It was a hell of a thing, and they were actually building like a big chain Chinese restaurant over here, and I managed to kind of experience the fresh off the boat, actually brought in a shipping container labor firsthand. It's quite a sight when you see it.
Did they have the smell of fried durian and mothballs?
Well, none of the people spoke English. There's a great story. One of the other engineers who was doing it was a lot older, and this guy comes up to him. He's like the foreman, starts like speaking Chinese, doing hand gestures, and the guy just looks him straight in the eye and says, "Well, a ching chong ding dong to you too," and walks off. Oh dear, that's pretty funny. But I think we should get into a couple of the links. I don't know if we're going to go over all of them, but there's a couple of them here that talk about the state of the market right now. There's just a Business Insider article, very ominously entitled, "Here's where the bond market is seeing volatility on par with the 2008 financial crisis."
Well, thanks, Business Insider. I didn't know.
And there's a bit, I don't want to cover it in detail, but there's a bit buried in here in which it says, it talks about mortgage-backed securities, and it says the central bank is committed to reducing its balance sheet, which mostly consists of the US Treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. So the Fed has hiked its rates and is now looking to basically dump some of the toxic debt that it has bought up. And I'm not quite sure who's going to. It might be repackaged by someone like BlackRock. I don't know who's going to do it, but.
Probably they'll be on that one again.
When you hear the term bond market volatility and mortgage-backed security sell-off by the Federal Reserve, you start to get a little bit nervous, or at least I do.
I think this is actually, I don't know how recent then, but this big push for green bonds. I mean, I first saw it coming through the pipeline. And being taught in universities, maybe like 6 or so years ago when I first started going to university. But now it's just, I mean, I can't go like a day without seeing like green bond this, like get like a LEED certification that. Like this big, I mean, it's Sustainability Inc. And you guys have done a great job covering, ESG and its implications, but I can see this as just, another financialization, another element of the financialization process where you have these perverse public private speculative bubbles, and this is just another one of them.
You are right. It does seem like this, the normalization of two, like 2008 conditions are now basically considered normal.
Well, I think you had actually, I think it's one of the links we've got at the end here, but seeing as you mentioned it, I think this is from China of all places.
You mentioned the mortgage-backed green security.
Mortgage-backed green securities are picking up in China as Beijing favors environmentally friendly buildings.
That's horrific.
Westerners have finally broken the back of one struggle and got them to cuck on eco issues. Probably just to
So,
keep the buddy Bank of China alive, but hey ho.
like on the housing prices, on the mortgage issue, one thing that I did pick up on a few years ago when I worked for a state DOT as an engineer, I rubbed shoulders with a lot of state planners, and one of the things I picked up on was that since the Great Recession, a lot of state planners have been throttling the conversion of agricultural land into suburbs in order to artificially throttle like single family housing supply, which, given like 14 years and a whole lot of throttling, what we have now are exorbitant housing prices, but you still have to pay exorbitant interest rates on your actual houses. And millennials are shuffled into the only the only buildings that are actually being constructed, which are these sort of like low to mid rise corporate landlord type five over one housing.
Yes, those are celebrated. Yeah. There's a lot of people on YouTube who talk about those as European style sustainable housing. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I actually really, really hate these five over ones. Like I lived in them. I've lived in them for the last few years, up until the last few months. And they're impersonal. Like I know that they're built incredibly shoddily. Five over one, of course, is a reference to the building codes that they're built around, where you only have to have one bottom level of concrete, well-made floor, and then above it, you can just use like cheap plywood to actually construct your building, and so they're incredibly cheap. They don't take up too much space. They can pack a lot of millennials in there. They have these like chic, like amenities that will sucker in God knows how many girls in their early 20s.
Oh God, yes! One of the buildings I'm currently working on has a mini cinema and a sauna that no one will ever use and things like that. That's the one that shakes when the planes go over it.
Yeah, it's like they have. Like after living them within these types of buildings for a few years, you know, they have gyms that no one uses, they have pools that no one uses, they have
stores that never turn over a profit.
Yep.
Yes. Like sometimes they'll have. I actually haven't seen any like stores actually in them. I think that might be like a Euro thing.
But that is a Euro thing. Yes.
Yeah. But. Basically, it comes from the fact that, in the U.S. at least, it comes from the fact that the urban planners don't want to actually convert farmland into suburbs for Gen Xers and millennials to buy, because they don't want to replicate the housing crisis. They want to throttle the development of the suburbs. And if you can't develop the agricultural land into suburbs, and if these urban planners also want to maintain a very dense core in the actual cities and sometimes suburbs, and they want to create these like chic, like green streets and stuff like that, you have on the periphery these very niche lots that can be built using this 5-over-1 municipal code to pack in all of the millennials.
It's the pods. Yes, it's the pod building. We went over this actually again in the Infinite Council State thing, in which the idea is what they are calling the 15-minute city.
Yes.
It's nightmarish when you actually read it, because they're admitting it's about demobilizing people. It's about restricting people's movement and keeping them in literally within 15 minutes of walking time of their house, and that you'll never leave that, basically without some sort of green pass. And that's what a lot of that is all about. They don't want suburbs because suburbs are quote unquote car reliant and that will cause the climate apocalypse. But really, it means that people are able to raise families. I think a lot of the reason for millennial childlessness is their housing conditions. They will never be able to afford the privacy they need to raise a child. I mean, I own a house. I own the house I try and get back there as much as I can, but I have to, for work, I have a flat in the south of England. So I have a house and a flat. And that is that kind of construction. It's very impersonal here. It's a mid-rise. It's all modern built. It's not, you know, it's chic-ish, but not, you know, it's built to a standard. It's like living in a giant motel, basically.
It is a step away from the pod, is what you're saying.
Yes, it is. It's the bridge to the pod, is what a lot of this is. And the arguments they make seem to make sense on paper to certain people, but also a lot of it as well is just about creating these weird hybrid living. Like it's imagine busing, like the high school busing, but on like a life, like a life level, on like a civilizational level. That's kind of what it's about.
It makes the surveillance state's job a lot easier at the end of the day. It's funny to think that both the rewilding stuff we've talked about before and construction, which we're talking about now, both have this sort of security state angle of keeping you penned in within a certain region and making sure that you are sort of electronically tagged, essentially, as you move around your 15 or 20 minute neighborhood. You use your local ID that makes you safe by meaning that you can't leave.
Well, in America, at least, people have reacted very negative. Well, I don't think we've had too many of these like 20 minute neighborhood or 15 minute neighborhood designs actually implemented. There's been a big push to restore main streets, and we've had a lot of perverse like green streets and stuff like that. But people can't afford these actual main streets, and the suburbs aren't being developed. But since COVID has come around, and since there was a big push to work directly from home, you've seen a lot of Californians just move out to rural areas that are now actually getting flush with like cash and Californians. In America, at least, we have room to grow and develop, and we have rural hinterlands that would love to get some investment. So we can, in America, at least, we can afford to run away from these horrible 20-minute neighborhoods.
Only so long, though, I think.
The problem with that, I was actually watching AA's stream on the American project being doomed, and his whole point, which I think is brilliant, about white flight, is that it's the sign of a rootless people. These people have no commitment to their neighborhoods. They have no commitment to where they live. They have no commitment to their community. They have no commitment to the land, you know, that they were born into, possibly, or that their parents owned. They just think, right, well, it's shit here, so I'm going to pack up and move elsewhere. And that's really how the Democrats have been able to take over the cities. Everyone moved out to the red ring of neighborhoods around it. Everything was gerrymandered, and then suddenly you end up with some sort of Democrat supermajority. You basically end up with Detroit and Baltimore, because everyone has decided that these conditions, we're not going to fight them, we're just going to leave them. And you
this
end
process
up with...
has been going on since like the 1860s.
Really. Oh, yes, of course it is.
Like one of the first things that, of course, like the Irish did whenever they showed up on our shores was create these urban machines in New York and Boston. We've had rotten cities for a long, long time, and the solution has always been preserve the land that is worth that is wealthy if you can, and if not, move to greener pastures and develop the hell out of it. But it does create like a whack-a-mole situation where,
yes,
like you create a nice white picket fence suburb, give it 20 years and some swarthy immigration into them. Like, and
I actually could see it when I was in Auburn for the Mises Institute. Like, they are in the last 5 years of that 20-year cycle, where white people have turned up, you know, now that the university's booming, and there's loads and loads of sort of those terrible wooden prefab houses have been thrown up in the last 10 years or so, because if they were any older than 10 years, they'd all rotted. And it's just like, all it's going to take is for that university to be dominated by Chinese and Pajit students, and every single white person that's living in Auburn will basically leave. And you'll have all the blacks from like Birmingham, Alabama, will move down. And
the only thing that you really have realistically are high housing prices, right? To keep the riffraff out and act as an artificial.
Well, you've got to remember though, there's teaching from home nowadays at universities. It's harder for, I think, landlords who rely on student populations to actually justify the rates that they do, because, you know, I've got this, that, and the next issue I need to learn from home, and just do your, you know, tutors via Zoom from wherever else you are. So I do get what you're saying. You know, if they force rent prices up, then it will stop immigrant populations moving in. But at some point, they've got to rent the houses out to someone, or they just knock them down and the place gets ruined. Either way, there is enough of a sort of escape out of it to cause a sort of drastic effect.
Well, I mean, the two mechanisms, right, are white flight out and gentrification in, if you can. And I guess like the cutting edge, like sort of modern day gentrification are these 5-over-1 developments. I'm not saying that they're good, but they get the job done in certain areas.
It's like a weird hollow gentrification, though. It's like hipsterification, yeah, yeah, almost.
Like, it is hipsterification. And if you look at certain areas in New York, a few of these hipsters have actually increased the number of white people in there and increased the number of Mexican and black people in there. It's weird. In some areas, hipsterification, like, hipsters are some of the best colonizers that we actually have, in a weird roundabout way, just in terms of how they bring up housing prices and they bring up rent.
So I've got an image up. This is 5-over-1 then, is it? It just looks like student accommodation.
I don't see it. I don't think it's on the stream yet. So.
It should be up now.
Okay, basically... Ah, right, there we go. Yeah, basically, it's like student accoms.
You know, like, here's your Tesco, whatever that brand is, Titan Store. But normally in the UK, you'd have your Tesco here, you'd have, like, a Barber's over here, round the other side would be, like, some horrendous vape shop.
Mid-rise they're building everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, these are identical to buildings in Europe. These are prefabs, actually. A lot of them come out of Germany. Europe just looks like that. Imagine hundreds of miles of these.
Yeah, I was in Munich suburbs is basically this for about 3 or 4 miles, I would imagine.
Oh, God, it is. There's these tiny little old town cores when I went to Munich for a couple months. And around them it looks like dystopian art. There are dozens of identical mid-rise polystyrene-clad white buildings with no character, no one on the streets. It's bizarre. It looks like the weird, unstructured space from Inception. It is that bad, though.
I think that might be a continental thing. Like when I was briefly... Like, it's just this, like, nightmarish... Yeah, it did remind me of kind of Inception, in the way that the buildings are just angular and grim in this very strange way.
But unfortunately, that is the vision of the future that American planners have for America as well.
That's all right, because we've already had it here since about the mid-80s.
We have a lot less prefab. Like, I'll post in the private chat here. What I see more often than not. Like, we have a lot less prefab and a lot more just cheap wood.
It looks like a giant jungle gym almost. You can kind of feel that it's made out of wood.
This is very what city center of Auburn looked like.
Yeah.
It's basically just an upmarket version of the same thing before.
Like, I don't know why they do it, but it's like they have these like on and off like striped patterns, and then usually at the first floor it's like brick or some sort of like faux stone, like stone facade that they glue on.
Oh god, the glued on stone.
Yeah, I mean, the glued on stone is the new, I guess it's a sort of architectural fad sort of midwit fad. Like, even my like parents like got like the glued on stone like added to their
oh, no, you're talking about like the horrible like sandstone cladding.
Yeah. But on the actual issue of white flight and rotten suburbs, and then the 5-over-1 like gentrification cope. I'm up for any sort of alternative. I really am. In terms of hard incentives, like, there is the alternative of going full like Chinese social credit system and lock up all of the ne'er-do-wells. That was the solution that New York came up with, right? It was the shoot, what was it? It was the broken window policy, right? Like the solution of the 1990s to the Ron City's issue was just lock up everyone who committed a minor offense. And I mean, it did work for a long while, but it doesn't address, you know, the suburbs. No, that, you can't actually implement that.
I was going to say that
practically.
They did basically try that in parts of the UK with like ASBO policy and house arrests and tagging. And it did not work, because all that meant was you gave these people an excuse to then rise up against the man again, because they were told, well, you know, you're on this tag thing, so you won't go to jail, but this, that, and the next thing, and it's only a fine. And I think there's possibly something to the what's the line from Rothbard about clearing the bums off the streets?
Yeah,
or whatever.
Sweep the bums from the streets, basically. Like, but he's not talking about like fining them. He's actually talking about like,
oh no, that's what Rothbard's, I mean.
He's like being very base and talking about like riding around your neighborhood executing the drug dealers and shit. He goes like full hardcore and it's kind of glorious. But the thing is, for a lot of people, the solution is go out and basically create new towns or buy up enough property in an area with like-minded people to create a community. Because the one thing these gentrified places lack is a community. They are increasing the material house prices, but they're not replacing the old-style communities that live there for hundreds of years here in the UK.
Well, I think that there is something as well to be said for the fact that it just, the way in which industry and specifically construction is so roundabout nowadays that there is no need to use local materials. There is no need to build buildings that last for 100, 200 years because, you know, nor is there the resources or the skills to do so anymore. There isn't also the sort of foresight and planning that would normally be required for someone to think properly about, you know, how to build. You know, I think about when I go into city centres in the UK and you've got some bank that's been sitting there since 1650 something, and it's got the same marble floor and the same stone pillars outside that it's had for the last 350 years. You know, the mindset that went behind building that was not the mindset you'll find on a construction site anymore.
Well, there's two things I want to bring up to move the discussion forward a little bit, because I want to get through some of these links. The Washington Post archive is the fact that mortgage rates have surpassed 6% for the first time since 2008. So borrowing costs have doubled in the past 9 months as the interest rate has increased. That's only going to get worse. But the second point is a lot of the houses people are buying, the apartments people are renting that have been newly built, I know for a fact the expected life cycle of most new builds before they need an extremely major refit, which basically means before they need tearing down, is coincidentally 25 years, which is the average length of a long mortgage here in the UK. It's kind of the default long-term mortgage here in Britain, and that they are essentially being built to that standard, that a lot of these buildings will be, that we're spending all this capital on, will be unfit for purpose, partially by design, in 25 years. And we have all these people who are paying higher interest rates for them, who will never pay off these buildings before they become too decrepit to be inhabitable.
It's almost like these houses are being built to prioritize being a credit instrument as opposed to being a functional home.
Yes, that is the point I was getting to there, is that these are really kind of weird financial instruments to sell mortgages more than being houses. And the crisis we have now, if we can continue with the current track, imagine like the crisis of 2050, when all of this splurge of building here in the UK that spent $7 billion on new housing, it all becomes basically uninhabitable over a 5-year period, because it will degrade pretty quickly once it hits about the 20-year mark. I don't know. Do you have a lot of like rotting housing stock in the US that isn't being replaced? Or is that not a I've heard that from some quarters, but
I think some areas, but I think that's much more of a regional issue. In the US, we have the issue of the fact that all of our infrastructure, like all of our highways and roads, were built in the 60s and 70s, and concrete has a lifespan of up to 60 years. So right now, every few years, we have to get $1 trillion infrastructure stimulus, just to replace existing infrastructure. I'm not too familiar with like any sort of housing, like material issues or cycles right now. But I can imagine something similar to that happening in the UK 25 years or whatever it is. For these 5x1s, yeah, all the plywood is incredibly cheap, but it's cheap to put up, cheap to replace, cheap to rebuild. So
I was going to say, in my experience, it's not actually that cheap to put up.
No.
You'd be surprised how much these projects cost. Because I was surprised being part of them, how much these projects cost to take to completion. In fact, I've not have it here. I'm going to use it for a different piece I've been working on for ages about brutalism. But there's a Bloomberg article which actually just admits straight up that the modern buildings, if you look at the numbers, cost the same to build as old-style buildings. It's not actually cheaper to build these.
I mean, like, in terms of, like, life cycle, like, some sort of life cycle analysis?
No, in terms of just, like, raw cost comparatively adjusted for inflation, to put up an office building in, like, 1910 made out of stone costs the same comparatively to put up one of these terrible plywood kind of condominiums or new office complexes.
I'm trying to remember, it not when we were in the Gallery of Modern Art in London, there was one of the exhibits had snippets from a New York newspaper that was advertising office space in like the 50s. And you were talking about like 9-story buildings with tens of thousands of square feet. And I think they were asking something like, you could buy it for like $500,000. That's quite a lot in 1950s dollars, but that's also a lot less than that building would cost you now.
There, I've done quite a study on it. It's a bit too much of a too big of a subject for this stream on its own. I don't want to go into too much detail, but the cost of buildings has stayed roughly the same, but the quality has reduced drastically. It's like what you see with like bread in the grain shortage now. It's like the price of bread has gone up slightly, but the quality of bread has dropped astronomically in Europe. And it's the same for all kinds of goods. But no, it's shocking to most people. But no, the big old stone buildings that will last hundreds of years in their time didn't cost any more than these horrible plywood buildings are costing now, just because of labor costs, taxes, supply, you know, knock-on effects from taxes, just the way that modern wage labor works, the way that modern, you know, the modern financial system works, is that you end up with these horrible, cheap buildings with short life cycles costing comparatively the same as the old building that was there before them that lasted 200-300 years sometimes. At least here in the UK, we had those buildings. It boggles the mind when you learn it. But I need to bring that out at some point. It's something I've had a lot of research on, but that does hold true that buildings has not got more expensive. Has not got cheaper over the years, despite the quality becoming immensely degraded. It's something that makes me like really angry when I learnt it, because we really could just be having all these old style buildings. It's not unaffordable. It's just that the world is so degraded we couldn't do them in the current framework. It's maddening, but that is the truth, that the cost of buildings has not come down with the dramatic quality decrease.
Like, in that case, I wonder if it has something to do with availability and just Britain being full. Could that just be it?
I think we don't have as much of the open space and sort of rural, you know, expanses where you could just throw up hundreds of houses at, you know, a horrendously low cost. That's really not quite as possible here anymore.
It's mostly, honestly, due to regulations and red tape.
Well, not a bad thing. It's a combining effect, though. I think if we had, you know, if there wasn't Greenbelt policy, they would be throwing Barrett homes up for half the price they're throwing them up now. It's just the land they're building them on is so inflated. I think, and furthermore as well, you could also look at it in the way that Scrum was mentioning before. even some of the new built stuff that is built here, I bet will last a lot longer than some of the stuff that's getting thrown up in California with new growth pine in it that doesn't even meet its like load bearing standards.
There's something to be said for that, but also, yeah, here in the UK, we generally have a slightly higher regulation environment, and we also do have less space. But apparently, that holds true in a lot of parts of the US as well.
Like some parts in the US, I guess. Like some areas are just development at all, but some urban areas do actually have a lot of squabbling over like who owns what. And just the impossibilities of doing construction work in some areas. I was actually out on this one demolition project in West Philadelphia a few weeks ago. I'll probably go out there in a few more weeks. But we were destroying this one bridge to replace it, and you know, just a few like I think it was only like maybe 50 feet away from one of our construction workers. He heard gunshots go off right next to him. And then an hour later, this one Uber was robbed at gunpoint, you know, a block away from us. You know, actually developing certain areas. But then there's like the land ability issue and urban planners throttling, you know, actual development, because they don't want to saturate the market too much with all of this, with even more suburbs. Like, if you want to develop suburbs, you also have to have the state invest in more roads that are capable of having more people drive on them, and they have to have more, like, water. You have to expand the water supply, and you have to put in all this new electrical infrastructure, and you have to, you know, see that there are more commercial areas. You have to be able to feed these people somehow. And so adding more housing and creating like new municipalities out of nowhere is kind of hard. And it's much easier just to like put up a few 501s here for the next generation.
Yes, I think that answers. There's a question from Glow in the Dark, for $10, asking why, from a financial standpoint, would construction companies want you to buy less? I think he means like single occupancy homes. He kind of answered it there that if you restrict the supply, if you only build these terrible 501 apartments, then a 501 apartment will cost the same as an old single occupancy house used to cost. They're able to sell less for more by doing that. It also goes on to say, some of the hospitals around me all have water damage. Some of these buildings haven't been around for more than 10 years. There's some very famous cases in Scotland about that, where they actually built the building so incompetently that the sewage system was leaking into the drinking water, and a whole bunch of newborn babies died. And that was just kind of swept under the rug. Nobody really went to prison for that. Just a whole slew of dead babies from basically cholera in a 21st century NHS hospital, and people just take it for granted. But the wider point I want to make though about this, we look at this, the lumber prices were very, very high for a long time. That was kind of a famous meme over the pandemic. But they've since plummeted, but not because of supply recovering. A lot of it is because of demand collapsing. And we've seen all the inflation that's happened. We've seen all the, as we talked about off air as well, the 50%, the 30% hikes in materials, things that cost, I think you said it was $125, now cost $300. You know, steel pipe work for me in my area, a lot of it's doubled, if not tripled. Some cases fabrication is difficult to do, and I know there's the whole green agenda, there's the EGS stuff, there's all of this, but do you think we might reach a tipping point in which some certain forms of vital economic activity become unviable, and we start to see like the actual collapse tipping point from all of these trends continuing?
Like in the US at least, like you could, like, the problem is that there's just not enough supply, and something has to give. Where I'm not exactly sure what it is.
It's actually quite worrying. This article is from the 14th. It's from yesterday, and they're talking about how the price is at $532. It's lost $50 in the last 24 hours. So not only is it a third of the price it was, you know, 14 months ago, you're going to get to the point where it's going to be unprofitable to start actually cutting trees out of the ground. In the same way we covered with the windfall profits on North Sea oil. It's no longer profitable to pull the oil out of the ground because of the windfall tax on top that they implemented during the pandemic. You're going to have a point whereby it's either going to be unprofitable to either pull the trees out of the ground or bother shipping them on a bloody train.
I don't think we'll reach that. I think that there's also been a lot of malinvestment in the area too. But sorry, you were saying, Clauston, about the Americans. You're right, something we'll probably have to give there.
Like, for housing and housing costs, the problem is that, like, the millennials need somewhere to live. And either they can just live in the pod, or something has to give, where a whole lot of land has to be converted into at least decent, somewhat decent housing. And if we have to import all of Poland here to actually build it, America's done worse. But you guys in Europe are a lot different, I think, in terms of actually having problems with unaffordable resources, and just like there's no profit to be made in the UK.
Well, I think the biggest problem resource wise is definitely labor.
So it's more or less just a labor shortage, or have enough cheap labor to justify.
Yeah, it's labor. Labor has become the, especially big industries like construction, labor becomes the thing that gets squeezed. Because your profit margins are slim, you can't squeeze your suppliers any more than you already are, especially when costs are going to go up in future. So you can't hold off on paying them off. You need to make the profit as soon as you can. So it's about cutting as much labour hours out of the process as you can, or finding it for as cheap as you can get. The bigger problem now is the fact that even in the 80s and 90s, they would solve that problem by basically, like, you know, groups of Polish guys, Bulgarian guys, Hungarian, those kind of groups. But they would come over for 6 or 8 months and then they would go back. So they would be here during, like, as you said, like a construction season. Whereas now, with all the different EU this, directive that, can't kick them out, this, that, and the next thing, it means they now stay here. So they now, actually, a lot of them will not take the cheaper wages they used to when they worked here part-time, because they're not paying Polish living expenses anymore. They're paying British living expenses.
Yes. And as we pointed to earlier, the average UK house price has gone up 15.5% year on year. So from July to July, it's gone up 15.5%, which is a astronomical rise in a house price over a year. It's ridiculous. And you're right, the issue is that it's not just unskilled labor, it's skilled. The real issue we have is skilled labor. I know that's a massive issue in US engineering as well, actually possibly even worse than it is here, the kind of the engineer gap, or just the skilled labor gap in general. I know the tech sector is the worst for doing the Pajit kind of insourcing that I talked about earlier, but there's a whole generation of, in my sector, engineers retiring. The boomers are leaving us. They are retiring, they're fucking off. And there really is nobody there to replace them. There's no pathway. I mean, people are out there doing, you know, environmental engineering degrees, they're out there doing drama degrees, nobody really has the skills. And even if somebody does have an engineering degree, they're underskilled. There's a link here. Where's that from? It's the when I talk about therapeutic state, but the Institute of Engineering Technology basically goes into that half of engineering companies have difficulty with labor, and 45%, 71% experiencing an internal gap report. It has been from engineering or technical skills. Most of them, like 93%, says that's impacted their work. basically up to a third of UK industry that involves engineering has had to cancel projects because they're short staffed, is what this is saying. And that's like, a huge problem.
Anecdotally, I would say that this, like for just about every engineering company that I've worked with, like they are starved for young talent. And then whenever they do actually get young talent, they'll work them to the bone, working extremely excessive hours. And like the boomers will cope by saying something like, you know, like back in my day, you know, it's just expected that like a 20 some year old will do like 60 hour work weeks in and just slave away for like the first 10 years of their professional life. But if you have the option to like fuck off and do some some slave finance job, you know, some soulless corporate job, you know, the option is almost always there. There's a ton of work to be done, but
not to satiate the boomer cope, but I think there is a point to be made with the fact that when, you know, there probably was a lot of people who did put their head down throughout the entirety of their 20s, learned a trade, and then sort of got up a ladder rung or two in their industry. I mean, that's what my grandfather did. He worked on buses. He was, you know, almost arguably not even really skilled labour at the end of the day. And he could pay for his mortgage on his house in less than 10 years fixing buses. So, you know, at least there was a reason for you to have your nose to the grindstone for over a decade. Because at the end of that decade, you might have two kids, a house paid for and a car paid for.
The incentives were different. I remember explaining this to someone at work, actually. One of the guys who does our auditing in terms of compliance stuff. He was talking about how, ooh, I used to work down the market and I used to get £5 a day when I was 15. So when I was 14 and I'd help out on my dad's stall. And I'd be like, look, you do realize that in accounting for inflation, when you were a 14-year-old, you got the equivalent of like 60 quid for like 4 hours work, right?
Mm.
So you, and then what got him to tell me what he was on his first job. And in his, you know, as a 21-year-old doing partially skilled labor, he was earning the equivalent of what would be £45,000 a year now. And you're right, the boomers have their cope, but the boomers were able to raise families on manual labor. They were able to work 60-hour weeks on construction and actually pay for a mortgage and actually buy a house and raise a family. Yeah. That incentive
because
doesn't exist.
They were actually building houses back then. Like now they aren't building actual houses. There's no land to actually develop. And the state isn't willing to develop anything anymore. So you have a generation of millennials that can't become professionals, but there's no point because...
Well, there was a generation of... Or shall I say, there was a cohort of professionals in millennial generation. It was all the ones that became weird tech heads and picked up some bizarre software package thing in the late 90s and early 2000s and became an expert in it, and all of a sudden started being able to subcontract or work out to some company for thousands of pounds an hour because they were the one person in whatever region that knew how to use this one obscure software. It's just wherever the bubble is.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real answer to this long term in this article anyway. They basically talk about the woeful investment in diversity. It's such a self-defeating point to say we don't have enough bodies, but we need to be choosy about which bodies we hire. There doesn't seem to be any managerial answer to this. The governments and the NGOs just have the same placating answers about education and diversity. And yet, I honestly think that certain industries in the UK and the US over the next 10 years will reach a technical skills breaking point in which there is no longer the expertise to maintain and renew certain types of technology and certain types of infrastructure. I do believe that we reached that point as many people who have been tangential to me have spoken about with nuclear power. I've had an outpouring of DMs from people who've been involved in UK nuclear power projects and said, yes, what you're saying is right. The skills don't exist in the UK anymore to make nuclear power plants. Mm-hmm. None of these will ever be finished. We have essentially in the UK and even with the French assistance, lost the ability to build nuclear power plants. And I don't think we'll regain that anytime soon. And I see that in my area of engineering, I see that in other areas of engineering, that there a skills kind of an engineer shortage is actually turning into like a civilizational level, like a Western skills loss almost. And that's kind of scary. That is actually collapse tier stuff. I don't know. How are things from an American perspective with that? Is that just a European thing, or do you think that trend could continue long enough term? Have we lost Clausing?
I'm sorry, I just had to do something real quick. Was that's question?
Fine. Oh, I was just saying that the skills gap that we've got, if it goes on long enough, could turn into like a permanent loss of skill, a permanent loss of the ability to do certain, like, infrastructure projects, or like we could almost in some ways re-third world ourselves by shrinking the pool of skilled labor so drastically by all this malinvestment and all the way that the economy is managed.
Well, in terms of personal anecdotes, I really don't think that like my particular part of the industry will be affected by something like that, just because in terms of design engineering, things are innovating. We're moving towards a much more streamlined way of actually designing infrastructure. It's a lot more like there's a whole lot less decisions that you actually have to make. You just have to follow certain design standards that the state already sets up for you. But I do have a friend who does do fabrication work for this one, like a sort of like plastic mold, like manufacturer. And he gave the exact same analogy that you did, where there just isn't anyone to replace the actual boomers in his particular field. And like third world knockoffs in like China just won't cut it. And so he's working off of like 40, 50-year-old machinery, but he's still much more productive than the actual Chinese market. But you're asking, like, what happens when certain industries do actually lose the ability to employ people with skills?
Like, yes.
Well, what happens to the nuclear power plants? Like, do we have, like, an idiocracy situation? And I mean, I guess yes. In some fields, that'll definitely happen. But someone somewhere knows how to work these plants, and if it just so happens that the UK has to import like thousands of like Persians
that's how we'll solve the Iranian nuclear crisis. We'll just steal just all the nuclear them. Engineers.
Well, I think that's one way out of it, but I mean, again, it's just cope. It's like how do you solve like the talent shortage? Just import more talent and then and mitigate the actual problems that come along with it.
The thing is, on a global scale, though, I don't think those people exist.
No.
I don't know where all these nuclear engineers are going to come from. I don't know where all these metallurgists are going to come from. I don't know where all these, you know, fabrication specialists, pressure vessel specialists, people who can work like injection molding machines like you talked about. Like, what happens to a factory when the last guy who knows how to work and service the machine that creates 30% of their goods, you know, decides to retire, and he's not trained anyone to replace him? There's instances like this I've heard of. Like, what happens when the guy who has all the technical knowledge to maintain the legacy projects you've had for the last 30 years, you know, has a heart attack and keels over at, you know, 65? You get enough of these instances, and you start to get kind of a third worldification of the way things are maintained.
I think I've mentioned it before on stream. It's sort of similar to what Hopper describes as the difference between hand work and mund work. You know, you're saying there, you know, in theory we could we could copy all these designs from previous nuclear power plants and rebuild them. But once you've lost the physical sort of experience of working with pressure vessels, working with dangerous materials, you know, once there was no one around who built the original power plants in Britain in the 70s and 80s, you know, I don't think they've built a nuclear power plant in Germany awfully recently. And even, as you said earlier on, with France's help, there is not enough people who have this prior handwork with the materials to be able to, you know, organize all the mund work around it so that it all fits together.
Yeah, it's we are coming, and I'm conscious of time here as well. I know you have to get back to doing stuff, Carsington. So I have a couple more donations I want to read out quickly. Just a couple more from Glowy, actually. He's been quite prolific this stream. But he says, just a quick correction on my previous post. No, I meant if they... Oh, obviously, if they made good homes, why would you incentivize them to build less bad ones? He's talking about basically planned obsolescence in housing, which is, yeah, that is a point that they are incentivized, really, for this almost planned obsolescence in housing.
Well, if
these,
you...
These perverse financial instruments.
If you build a house that's meant to last more than 25 years, the people who buy the house are going to care about what maintenance costs are. If no one's incentivized to hold on to the house for more than 25 years, who cares what the maintenance costs are, what the upkeep is?
And it says decades ago, whites used to do construction almost exclusively in my area, and then the Hispanics moved north and moved in. They took over a bunch of positions and almost did it as almost all under the table works. Whites usually still are the majority of heavy equipment operators. Blacks just usually hold signs. Why is that? Something bell curve, something skilled work.
One standard deviation and IQ gap.
Yeah, it usually is because those people are actually distributed in 10 IQ increment gaps. On a macro level, you probably couldn't get enough people of, let's say, different ethnic background who can do the skilled work of operating like proper heavy machinery without a China situation of live leak logos every time you move a crane. why is that live leak logo there?
Well, I think China and the sort of bell curve situation happened. The live leak phenomenon, because we import the right hand side of the bell curve, the Pajits and the Chinese, we get all their intelligent people, but we forget that there is an entire left hand of the bell curve.
Oh, yes.
in India and China, who do get up to certain shenanigans and do bad work.
But the poo does not indeed go in the loo there now. They just can't engineer it. Well, there's a good video by the guy called China Uncovered, who does a lot of pretty good China coverage, about the classic case is the Chinese ballpoint pen, and that the Chinese couldn't make ball bearings to a close enough tolerance to make a workable ballpoint pen until about 2012, and China really exists.
Jeez.
Yeah, China exists on stolen Western IP. They buy secondhand Western equipment, and China is completely on Western technical life support. That if we withdrew, they would essentially go back to the 1920s, if not earlier. And the issue is that we are doing the same thing to ourselves, that there is a small group of people with legacy heavy industry skills that are being ruled over by a class of technocrats with their heads in the clouds, in many cases, with the future tech stuff that they bring out, and with the greenification of capital, and then the greenification of engineering. Those things don't actually work in reality. You end up against thermodynamics, and the weird skyscraper curse. The future may end up not being the skyscraper curse, but like the energy plant curse. You know, the solar farm curse. And it's all well and good to laugh at somebody for building a big, ridiculous building and then going bust. But when the equivalent of that causes your lights to go out, it starts to get a bit less funny. And that's really when we talk about all this stuff, about the perversion of money, the perversion of markets. That's the end result of it. The logical conclusion is that it's not just woke people get employed, as talking heads like to talk about. It's not the fact that the wrong people get rich. It's the fact that the energy grid at some point with these policies will fail. You will no longer have electricity. You will no longer have a workable transport system. You will no longer have the ability to accurately fabricate any kind of material, really, if we end up in this situation. And that is the real danger at the end point of this. A lot of people accuse our streams of being blackpilled, but you search on the news housing market and housing bonds, and all you get is highest level since 2008, highest level since 2008, surpassing 2008. You know, you get Chinese green ESG housing, mortgage-backed green securities. You can't glance at it. I know some of it is like actual fear porn now. They're kind of playing it up almost, because they want to do this demobilization. But there's something to be said about being aware of what's going on and seeing the signs, as it were. I don't know. Before we end out here, is there anything you want to add or shill, Glossington?
Let me see. Anything that I want to add? Well, if there are very niche industries that are going extinct, anyone watching would be could easily find a niche, occupy that niche, and then make a whole boatload of money, and then send us some super chats later.
Yes, please do. That's a wise idea. Come on, Wes.
They're very hard to get into, but yes, that's good advice.
So in terms of white pills, there is money in yonder hills. If you find these niches, you know, you shall inherit the earth. Go become a nuclear engineer, the last nuclear engineer in the UK.
That's the one, the last nuclear engineer.
And, learn AutoCAD and learn Autodesk products.
Yes. I actually really like Autodesk. Like back in high school, I got my start off Autodesk inventor.
Inventor fag. I like Inventor. I support SolidWorks, but
we had a 3D printer that only used or that mostly used like Inventor. So it's I like to be somewhat optimistic. If you find a niche, you know, great for you. If you know, here there is that white pill where it's cheaper to, or it costs just about as much to create a house with old stonework as it does with modern products. So, you know, once you make bank on being the last nuclear engineer in the UK, go out and buy yourself a nice stone trad house.
And, just basically, if you get the capital and you if there is some sort of collapse situation where people stop caring, putting up very nice buildings will suddenly become very, very cheap. if things like become the bulwark against the collapse and become the people with the skills, if the collapse does happen, that are useful. I did the same thing. I found my niche. I work in quite a niche industry. In fact, it's so niche I don't want to name it, because it's a very small industry in this country, really. But yeah, it does. You are able to be paid very, very high wages comparatively and you're able to also set your own terms as well. You have the power in the relationship when it comes to the employer, because you are mobile labor and they know that they have to placate you at least in some way and value you in some way. So getting into these industries and finding these niches is a great way to have a secure and, I guess, valued working life as well. It's much better than being a what people refer to as like a wage pig or a wagey get in the cagey. It's much better than working for Amazon. So that is a good white pill.
Yeah, and if we want to go with like white pills, there is something to the millennial and Gen X sort of hustler culture that rejects the wagey that like Gen X has cynically. In their cynicism has fallen into, like millennials and Zoomers looking for niches. You know, as absurd as the niches might end up being, you know, they do exist, and you know, the entrepreneurial spirit shall survive, even if we, and if you're just so happen, if you just so happen to be skilled and entrepreneurial enough, you might just be one of the last people to buy a boomer home. So, so go out there and go do it.
Yes, I will say why. But I, despite it needing some work doing to it, as Evelyn does know, I did manage to live the dream and buy a house without having to get a mortgage, which was very beneficial. But yeah, that I am currently living the boomer dream of having a property without a mortgage. But it's difficult to do. But it is if you get yourself into that position, it is possible and it is very worthwhile. We're surviving the inflation quite well, partially because of that actually. It is a good bulwark to have. Make yourself collapse resistant, and one of the best ways to do that is to have worthwhile capital, have tangible goods that you own, and have a worthwhile technical skill that there is such a big lack of. I always encourage people to disregard all this tech bullshit. Don't go into the tech sector. That's all going to go away at some point. It's all going to be done away with because it's just a massive capital injected make work scheme. Learn how to do something that's actually valuable and productive. Gain a marketable skill, and you will inherit the earth. That is correct.
I keep on hearing like coders and programmers complain about shoddy people that go into the comp sci field and aren't actually up to snuff and just get into it cynically, because they hear, you know, Silicon Valley has so much money, just learn to code. Actually, don't learn to code. You can find a much better niche somewhere else.
Yeah,
and there learn are niches out there. Yeah, learn to build.
Yes, learn to build. Be debt free.
Mm-hmm. Right, there we go. There are the lessons from this evening. Yes. learn to build your own house and never have a credit card.
Let me double check. I have not missed any super chats. I don't think I have, though. There's a couple of clarification ones here, but I think people have read them and they're kind of along the same vein. So I'll. Oh, there's one here, sorry, from Arnold Dr. Pepper. I have missed. It said, in another lifetime, King Charles III devolves Parliament and appoints himself Minister of Architecture and Leveling Up. You have been warned. Oh, no. Please don't bring us to this dark future, Arnold Dr. Pepper. In terms of shilling. I don't know if you want to put it in the chat, or I will. We're still selling tickets for the Nomos event.
We are
hopefully
indeed.
Either later this week or early next week have some announcements for speakers and theming.
There will either be one announcement at the end of this week or two next week.
Yes, so we'll see with that. We are going to have like a rapid succession of information and some quite, you know, quite exciting speakers that some people might not have seen for a little while or might struggle to see. So we'll do get your tickets while they're still available, while the hype is relatively low. Although we have sold, I think, about 20, just over 20 of them now.
I think
which is not.
We must be getting closer to 30, I would think.
But... No, I think it's only about 20, but we haven't had the major announcements yet, so that's to be expected. But we sold most of the early bird tickets, so that's still going. If you guys want to check out Clausen's and stuff, I've linked his Telegram below and his YouTube channel. He doesn't upload very often at the moment, but he does have it there if you guys want to keep track of him. And you do post on your Telegram pretty often. That's quite an active community, so I would recommend that one. I tend to post in the chat there sometimes as well. We do have our Substack. I'm trying to prepare a few more articles for that, but I'm still on kind of the research phase with a lot of those. And we have that whole like 7-part series I set up about organizational building that we have the skeleton for that we'll have to finish at some point.
Too much stuff going on, but hey ho. Anyway, good evening for me.
Yes, if there are any super chats that I missed this time, I'll read them next time. Streamlabs is actually not behaving itself right now, so I actually can't see them. I'm sorry. And the YouTube backend is no luck. It basically has a blank viewer activity thing going on. So yeah, that's thank you YouTube, very cool. But I'll make sure that anything that got missed will get read out next time. I do try and make sure I catch all of those. Thank you to Clausen for coming on. Thank you for your good insights.
Indeed.
You're obviously very clued up on all this stuff.
It was a pleasure to attend this. Now I need to get back to work. I have infrastructure.
Yes, I'm going to take us off air now. So goodbye from me and have yourselves a good evening.